got a couple of blank spots, and if you see a spot that you want me to be on, I'll just start with you, Jeff, and pass it around. Please put your name in. And does anybody need a handout?
Yeah, I gave one away.
Going once, going twice. Back and back.
Hello.
We almost did not recognize you today, Rocky.
I'm sorry, what?
We didn't recognize you.
I know.
Very properly dressed. Are you going to stand up?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Don't get used to this. I do want you to know that I now have a new favorite pair of socks, thanks to Gary Swindell back in the back. And I promise I will wear these next Sunday, so be prepared. I'm just warning the UT fans, if this bothers you, you know, just so you'll know. Thank you, Gary.
Hey, Rocky, can I wear UCLA socks?
Absolutely. But no USC socks. Well, it seems like it's been forever since I've sat here with all the things that happened the last few weeks. This is lesson number 19 in the book of Genesis. And the title of today's lesson is Abraham, Lot, and the Battle of Sodom. Since our church calendar has been a bit unusual for the last few weeks, ABC classes being canceled twice in a three-week period, due to the Mission Sunday and then the all-church single service that we had last week. You may not remember this, but I was a bit amused at the different opinions expressed about Lot the last time we got together. And by amused, I don't mean anything at all negative, because Lot poses a real challenge for us in trying to understand him in the context of these stories. Some of you wanted to give Lot at least somewhat a benefit of the doubt regarding some of the things that he did, while there were others who expressed a rather low opinion of him. I thought a lot about this over the last couple of weeks. I may take a little bit of a harder line in my evaluation of Lot than some of you, but I understand that there are matters of the heart which simply we don't understand. As for myself, I tend to look at Lot as the Lincoln Riley of the Old Testament. Now, I really thought that... I really thought that would get a better response than it. For those of you who don't know, Lincoln Riley is the football coach who abandoned our football team in Norman, Oklahoma to go to USC, leaving Norman in the middle of the night. So I'm going to say that again, and I would appreciate it if you would laugh. I tend to see Lot as the Lincoln Riley of the Old Testament. There you go. A man lacking in loyalty, motivated solely by his own self-interest, and deceptive in his dealings with people who gave him great opportunities. So let's talk a little bit about this man named Lot. In Genesis chapter 11, verse 27, we read, Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran became the father of Lot. So Lot was a family member of Abram's family, and that facilitated some responsibilities toward him on the part of the patriarch, his family. In Genesis 11:31, after Abram's called out of Mesopotamia, we read, Terah and took Abram his son and Lot, the son of Haran his grandson, and Abram his and his wife Sarah, his daughter-in-law, and they set out for the land of Canaan. So Lot left Mesopotamia with his grandfather Terah and with his uncle Abram. They headed out together to the land of Canaan. So far, so good. But in Genesis 12, Abram goes down to Egypt to escape a famine in the land of Canaan, and he got in trouble there with the king of Egypt, who kicked him out of the country. And in this context, we read in Genesis 13, chapter 13, verse 1, Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, and Lot went with him. Here's the problem. Lot brought a lot of Egypt back with him to Canaan. Not so much the material things, though we know both Abram and Lot came back as wealthy men, but in the sense that Egypt got into Lot's heart, and Lot never quite got Egypt out of his heart. Lot was enamored with Egypt. We see this when we read between the lines of Genesis 13, verse 12. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, but Lot pitched his tent towards Sodom. This word, but, is what we call a conjunction of contrast. And as such, it sets one thing against another in antithesis. Actually, two things are contrasted here. Lot and Abram, and Sodom and Canaan. You see, Sodom was as close to Egypt as you could get without literally crossing back over the Sinai Peninsula to the land that nearly ruined Abram. So think about this. Think about the Jews when they got in trouble in the wilderness. Toward what did the collective heart of Israel turn when things got difficult? I want you to listen to a few complaints that were posed by the Israelites, and most of these are from Numbers chapter 14. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, and listen to what they said, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of Israel. Lot was a problem, and the Lot problem carries over in today's passage, which is going to be Genesis 14, verses 1 through 16. Last week we left Abram dwelling in peace by the oaks of Mamre near Hebron in the Negev, and Lot was in his tent in the vicinity of Sodom. This setting could not be better for contrasting the stories of these two men, one man representing a life lived by faith, the other showing us the danger of moral and theological compromise. If ever there was a time when the Church of Jesus Christ needs to learn this lesson, it's today. When in Matthew 6, verse 24, Jesus said, "No man can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." It's equally true that man cannot serve God and at the same time compromise with the culture that's being guided by none other than Satan himself. And I hope you do realize that the direction our culture is taking today is modeled by Satan to prepare the world for the great tribulation. What's being promoted as a new way of looking at things is not new at all. What's claimed to be a new enlightenment is not light, but darkness. And it isn't new. It began for the human race long ago in the Garden of Eden. As I just mentioned, in Genesis 12, both Abram and Lot had gone to Egypt to escape the famine that had come upon the land of Canaan. Abram made some really bad decisions there that jeopardized his wife's life and almost cost him his own neck. But Abram's faith was restored when he returned to Bethel and he confessed his sin to the Lord. Abram learned a lesson from his experience in Egypt that changed him for the better, but Lot didn't. Lot brought Egypt back to Canaan in his heart, and therein lies the difference in Abram and his nephew. Lot saw the riches and the wonders of Egypt and he wanted that light for himself. Abram saw his personal failure, and he wanted something very different. He wanted forgiveness. In Genesis chapter 13, after both Abram and Lot returned to Canaan, tension arose between Abram's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot, because as we both know, both of these men came back from Egypt wealthy men. This was an issue practical in nature. It's the same experience that they had as the experience that businessmen and women have every day in our time. There were insufficient resources, insufficient water, insufficient pasture lands, so a separation became necessary. Beyond this practical matter, there were unbelievers living in the land beside Lot and Abram, Canaanites, Perizzites. They were living there, and dissension in the family of faith was not an acceptable situation from Abram's point of view. So he took the initiative to resolve this problem. Now, it was Abram who had claim to all the land, in the sense that he had been promised that land under the Abrahamic covenant, something we've studied in some depth and will do again. But he didn't actually own any property. Nevertheless, he seems to have been in a position to dispose of the land in some way. The easy solution for this problem was to send Lot away to fend for himself. Lot could not have protested because Abram was the recipient of the promises and he was the patriarch. He was the man with authority. But in an act of generosity, Abram gave the choice to Lot by saying, "You choose the land you'll take for yourself, and I'll take what remains." This tells us a lot about Abram, the man. He was willing to make an expensive personal sacrifice to ensure the relationship with his nephew remained strong. On the other hand, Lot was willing to risk his relationship with his uncle to take advantage of an opportunity to enrich himself. So, in a decision based on his own greed, a greed that I believe was fostered by his time in Egypt, Lot chose the best land for himself. He chose an area that's known as the Circle of the Jordan. Now, if you've been to Israel, you know the region around the Dead Sea is absolutely desolate. Upon seeing that area, you can't help but wonder how the most resourceful desert animal, much less a human being, could live around the Dead Sea. By comparison, the area around the Grand Canyon is a paradise compared to the Dead Sea region of southern Israel today. And of course, this calls to question why the Bible would describe the Circle of the Jordan as the best land. If this is the best land, what on earth was Abram's land like? Well, apparently the judgment that God brings on Sodom and Gomorrah a few chapters down the road changed this region dramatically from a fertile land to a desolate wasteland. So what we see today is not what Lot saw 4,000 years ago. Lot's decision should be interpreted both literally and symbolically. Lot pitched his physical tent towards Sodom, and in so doing, he turned his heart in that direction as well. So in this story and in the one to follow, we'll see how these two men, both believers, came to a fork in the road of life and made choices that defined them from that point forward. So in this story, and in the one to follow, we're going to see how these two men, how their lives changed. And in Genesis chapter 14, we will see the consequences of the choices that they made and how these consequences play out in the lives of Abram and Lot. And along the way, we'll meet the mystery man of the Bible, a man named Melchizedek. So let's read about our major topic for today, the Battle of Sidim and the rescue of Lot by Abram. So we're going to read Genesis chapter 14, verses 1 through 16. And it came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birshah, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these came as allies to the valley of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zazim in Ham, the Emim in Sheba-Kiriathaim, and the Horites in the Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, which is in the wilderness. Then they turned back and they came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and conquered all the country of the Amalekites, also the Amorites who lived in Hazazon-Tamar, and the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out, and they arrayed for battle against them in the valley of Siddim, against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. But those who survived fled to the hill country. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. And they also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. Then a fugitive, or an escapee, came and told Abram the Hebrew. Now, he was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and the brother of Anir. And these were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went to pursue them as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and he brought back also his relative Lot, with his possession and also the women and the people. And I'm going to get a drink of water after all of those words. So at the beginning of our story, there are two groups. And I hope you all figured this out. There are two groups. We're going to make this simple. Two groups controlled by 9 kings. And we're going to call them the Eastern Alliance and the Western Alliance. The kings were more like mayors or sheriffs than kings. They use this word. They controlled, at least for the day, a significant military force, but they were not kings in the sense that we think of kings. So think of this. You've got a group of kings and their soldiers from the east, and then you have another group of kings and their soldiers from the west. This Eastern Alliance consisted of 4 of these kings. Chedorlaomer, who was the king of Elam. Elam is in southwestern Iran, also known as Persia. Amraphel, the king of Shinar, this is the region around Babylon. Arioch, the king of Elazar, it's an unknown location. And Tidal, the king of Goyim, also is an unknown location. So these are the 4 kings of the Eastern Alliance. Yes, sir?
Goyim, in modern Hebrew, that just means the nation.
Right? It means nations or Gentiles.
Is the reading here that Goyim is a more specific defined place?
Yes, it would have been a defined region occupied by, I don't really know if you can say Gentiles at the time, because there's really that Jewish-Gentile division doesn't exist yet. So this is a specific place named Goyim. The Western Alliance. Bera, the king of Sodom, located near Siddim, which is also called in the passage the Salt Sea, or we would call it the Dead Sea. Birsha, the king of Gomorrah, also located near Siddim. Shinab, the king of Admah, another unknown location. Shemeber, the king of Zeboiim, also an unknown location. And then there's an unnamed king. We don't know the king's name, who rules over Zeboiim, which the text says is also modern day, or at least in the time of Moses, Zoar, located south of Sodom. So we have some unknown locations here, but they're probably all territories located east of the Jordan River, somewhere in the vicinity of Syria, Edom, Jordan, and Moab. Our chapter opens with the first battle that's recorded in the Bible. 14 years before the events of Genesis 14, the Eastern Alliance, under the leadership of Chedorlaomer, had attacked and defeated the Western Alliance, and the kings of the West were forced to pay an annual tribute or tax to these Eastern kings. And this served two purposes. The taxes brought revenue into the coffers of the Eastern Alliance, and it was a way of imposing submission on the kings of the West. 1 year before the events of this chapter, the Western Alliance had rebelled and stopped paying taxes. So the following year, Chedorlaomer led the armies of the Eastern Alliance south and then westward to reestablish control over the kings of the West, and the fighting that followed is known as the Battle of Sidim. I'm surprised they haven't made a movie out of this. It'd make a great movie, and if this were the script of a movie, it would come from these 16 verses that we read today. This is a film where things would get blown up. There'd be explosions. There'd be bands of good guys pursuing bands of bad guys. Exactly the kind of movie guys like to see. Abram's part might be played by John Wayne. Or better, I think a better choice would be Marshall Dillon. Now, I'm not quite sure how the script writers would work Festus and Miss Kitty into the story, but I think it could be done. The worst movie I ever saw was a movie Linda dragged me to years ago. Some of you probably saw it. It's called The English Patient. Now, I was persuaded to attend this movie because of a deceptive moment in the previews that showed this beautiful yellow biplane crashing in the desert. And I remember thinking, this is great, an airplane movie. But to my dismay, when I got to the movie, the airplane appeared in the movie for a total of 15 seconds. Then for two hours, a patient, thus the title, lay in bed dying. This movie on the Battle of Sidim would not be that kind of movie. This movie would focus, and it would actually serve an interesting purpose. It would serve as the context, and by that I mean not an end unto itself, but the context for a more significant story to follow, which is the spiritual battle that involves Abram, the king of Sodom, and Melchizedek, a storyline that we'll get to in our next lesson. The opening scene of this movie would be a wide panorama of horsemen riding across the desert, manes and tails of horses flying in the wind. The first battle scenes would take place just south of Syria, near Ashtaroth. And along the way, villages would be pillaged and burned. Men would be slaughtered by sword-wielding horsemen. And women and children would be made widows and orphans as their husbands and fathers fell before the swordmen of evil Chedorlaomer. Then the scene would shift to the territories and the hills around the Jordan Valley. Jordan, Edom, Moab, and this horde of soldiers would finally make their way to Kadesh in the Negev, which is the southern desert area. And finally, these eastern armies would turn to the northeast in the direction of the Dead Sea towards Sodom and Gomorrah, where the Valley of Sidim exists, and it was there that they would then engage the armies of the Western Alliance. So it was near the southern end of the Dead Sea that Chedorlaomer led his troops against this Canaanite alliance of the West. And it was there that the kings of the West fell before Chedorlaomer and his allies. Verse 10 is interesting. It tells us something about the area around Sodom. It was full of tar pits, or we'd probably say asphalt pits, a naturally occurring a petroleum substance similar to molasses in consistency. They used it in the Middle East for mortar. A tar pit would be an unpleasant place to spend very much time. And apparently for these kings, They made a good hiding place. And remember, the kings in question here are the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. So they were locals. They knew the area. The word that's translated fell can also mean hid in Hebrew. It's the word nafal. So it says they fell into the tar pits. I actually think a better choice here would be to say they hid in the vicinity of these tar pits. And furthermore, the Hebrew does not say that they fell into the tar pits. It says they fell there. So this is a little bit different when you look at it in Hebrew. So I think what this means is that they came to this area that was populated by tar pits and they hid there. That's what happened here. This is not, they're not dying here because the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, they were locals. They would have understood the area. They would have known the location of these tar pits, and thus they were able to avoid them and actually use them for their benefit, whereas the foreigners from the east didn't know the area. They would have been unfamiliar and probably considered the entire area to be quite dangerous. Now, maybe it's just me, and I know this probably doesn't happen to you, but for just a moment, when I was studying this, I had this vision of Br'er Rabbit. You know, any place but the briar patch, except in this case, it's any place but the tar pits. Because they know if they can get the Eastern Alliance to chase them into the tar pits, that's a good thing for these kings of the West. But what's more convincing about all this is the fact that the king of Sodom later comes out to meet Abram, and he appears to be the same king who hid there, so we know he survived. Verses 11 and 12 seem clear that the battle was won easily by Chedorlaomer and the Eastern Alliance. It appears they attacked the Western kings with near impunity. While the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah hid from Chedorlaomer in the tar pits, a few others fled to the hills and escaped. But many others were captured. And then this is where this gets really interesting. Among the ones who were captured was Lot, Abram's nephew. Were it not for Lot, we wouldn't know anything about this battle. There must have been similar skirmishes that occurred throughout history, but we have no record of them. But this particular battle involved Lot and his uncle Abram, and God chose to preserve it for us. It gives us the account here in Genesis for reasons that I'll point out in just a moment. Abram surely knew that there was military action underway in the region, but it didn't concern him. He had no dog in the fight, or at least he thought he didn't. Abram had a change, though, because an escapee, someone who got away, he's called a fugitive, I think, came and he tells Abram something that changes everything. He gives him a bad report. In verse 12, he says, "The eastern kings have captured Lot, your brother's son, who was living in Sodom, and they've departed with Lot and with all of his possessions." This explains the motive for Abram's involvement. Lot has been taken hostage. Last week we read Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom. Verse 12, we found out Lot had moved into the city proper. Despite this, Lot was his nephew and Abram loved him. Lot's been captured. His possessions have been stolen. And that's sufficient reason for Abram to act. And this brings us to lesson number one from this text. If we're attentive to the text, we'll learn that choices we make today will bear fruit tomorrow. Lot's choice of the Jordan Valley was motivated by one thing, self-interest. It gave him an opportunity to increase his own wealth. It was a choice made by greed. A life built on self-interest alone is a life that will progress down a road that leads to a never-ending quest for more. But more is never enough. For Lot, this road led to Sodom, not to the outskirts of the city, but to city central. Lot's life typifies the end result of seduction and his casual acceptance of what Sodom had to offer, and it was an offer that resulted in a compromise with evil. And this is lesson number two. When evil is tolerated, we come under its influence. You can take that to the bank.
Rocky?
Yes, sir.
Is Gomorrah right next to Sodom then?
Yes. Yes.
Cities.
Yeah. If you look at that one of those maps, I put a photograph side by side with a depiction, and you'll notice that the Dead Sea looks different. Okay, so the time of Abraham, before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the Dead Sea that we see today in the photograph entailed about two-thirds of that area, and you can see the difference in those two depictions. Sodom and Gomorrah and the Valley of Siddim would have been just south of the image on the right side of your handout. It's probably covered by water now. So there's a major topographical change to the area there. I think we need to be aware of this idea of tolerating evil, because if you look around us today, the United States is becoming very much like Sodom. We're exactly going down the same road as these people. One thing that became obvious to me when the whole COVID pandemic started, it became obvious to me in a real way. I think I knew this intellectually, but I became aware that God can take down any nation in a day if he chooses to do it. Before Chedorlaomer knocked on Lot's front door, Lot never would have believed the provisions that he had made for himself, his wealth, his possessions, his 401k, whatever he had, could possibly fail him. But they were gone in the blink of an eye. Verse 13 is interesting. It refers to Abram as the Hebrew, and you may recall the word Hebrew means the one who crossed over, and it referred to Abram being the foreigner who had crossed over the Euphrates River. But now he's in Canaan, and his fame is rising in prominence among the Canaanites, living in the land God ultimately will give to the descendants of Abram. At this time in Abram's life, he was a clansman, not unlike the tribal chiefs who lived around him. We'll see these as we go through the chapter. It might be an overstep to say that Abram had achieved worldwide acclaim at this time, but he was a force to be reckoned with, and we'll soon see this. This may be one reason the account of the Battle of Siddim is preserved for us in the Abrahamic narratives. God blessed Abram, and by extension, he blessed Lot through Abram's great victory over the foreign kings that had invaded the land God promised to the patriarch. Remember, Lot was not a direct descendant of Abram. He was a relative, but he was not a direct descendant. This is important to know because, as such, Lot was not under the covenant. You ever thought about this? He's not a direct descendant of Abram. Therefore, the Abrahamic covenant, which was made with Abram and with his descendants, does not apply to Lot. He was not a direct recipient of the covenant blessings in the sense that Abram, Isaac, and Jacob were. His deliverance by Abram grew out of family loyalty, not because Lot was a covenant man. If you want to think about it this way, Lot was blessed through Abram in the same way we are. God had said to Abram, "All the nations of the earth will be blessed through you." Lot's deliverance was an indirect blessing that came through the agency of Abram. Now, a small rabbit chase here. Because I've never been able to think of a better way to say it, I've used the phrase overflow blessings to refer to how the church is related to the new covenant. So hang with me a minute. The new covenant was ratified by Jesus with Israel at the Last Supper, not with the church. Not one Gentile or Christian was in the room when Jesus said, "This is the new covenant in my blood." Only Jews, only direct descendants of Abram were in that room. The new covenant blessings are extended to the church because God made a covenant with Abram. Lot regained his freedom because God promised to bless Abram. And those promises brought about Lot's rescue from what was obviously a stronger, more numerous military force at a time when Lot could have done nothing to save himself. This pattern of God giving Israel military victory over her enemies is a pattern that will be repeated through the ages. Abram may have acted in response to the kidnapping of a family member, but there was a deeper, more significant purpose at work. God is fulfilling his covenant promises in full view of Abram, Lot, and the surrounding nations. Abram's given a great victory over his enemies, and his name and his fame are on the increase among his peers. As for Lot, he serves as an example of the veracity of God's promises he serves as a proof of the veracity of God's promises, because God had promised Abram, through you all the families of the earth will be blessed, and Lot was rescued solely as a result of his association with Abram. While God's promise, the one who curses you, I will curse, is clearly evident in the defeat of the invading kings. And I think these are the reasons that God preserved the account of the Battle of Sidim, so that we could see how he's beginning to fulfill these promises that he's made to Abram. The capstone of the story will come when the king of Sodom, and we'll see this next week, tries to make a deal with Abram in the latter part of this chapter. But Melchizedek will enable Abram to see what really lay behind the king's earthly offer. Reminded by Melchizedek of God's promised blessing, Abram will resist the temporary benefits of a deal with the pagan king, preferring instead the eternal blessing of the divine promises. Because Lot's decision years earlier were made as they were, Abram was thrust into this fight that he didn't start and he didn't want. But when Abram heard Lot had been taken captive, he armed his trained servants. There were 318 men, men who were loyal to Abram, and they set out to rescue Lot. His men were trained in military tactics. They were prepared for whatever might come their way. They were men of faith, but they also were men of might and courage. They were able to defend themselves, and they were willing to defend the defenseless. And Abram didn't go alone. Verse 13 explains he was confederate with an Amorite named Mamre and his brothers Eshcol and Aner. The word confederate, or I think your text may say allies, it's actually Baalei Berith. It's an interesting little Hebrew phrase. It means lords of the covenant. So what it's telling us here is that Abram and this Amorite, Mamre and his brothers, were allies. There was an agreement of some sort between these men. And it's probably worth pointing out that, unlike Israel some 400 years in the future, Abram had not been given much information about the Canaanite population. He's not been told to avoid contact with them. He's not been instructed to engage them in a war, as Israel will do under Moses, and especially under Joshua's leadership during the conquest. Abram isn't to displace them at this time or to take their cities. Now, in the next chapter, in the 15th verse of chapter 15, Abram will be told that he's going to live a long life. He's going to go to his fathers in peace. Then in the very next verse, verse 16, he'll learn that following a time of absence, his descendants will return to take this land from the Canaanites. Abram's descendants will be the recipients of God's promises, but they also will be the arm of God's judgment against the Canaanite tribes. But at this particular time, when the events of Genesis 14 took place, the iniquity of the Canaanites was not yet full, and it was not time yet for God to judge them. But at the time of the events took place, there's a problem, and there's an agreement that Abram has, a legitimate agreement with Mamre. He understood he was living among people who worshiped idols, but this is not new to Abram. He came from Mesopotamia. He's well acquainted with this. And here's the point. Abram was expected to live among the Canaanites, but his life was to be representative of his relationship with Yahweh. He was expected to live a life different from the lives of the Canaanites. This does not mean a self-righteous life, but it does mean a life based on different values. We're admonished to do exactly the same thing. In a world that believes mankind evolved from a primordial chemical soup, we're to proclaim God as our creator. In a world that holds to a moral equivalency between homosexuality and the union of man and woman in the divine institution of marriage, a covenant relationship that reflects God's design for mankind, we must resist the pressure to conform. And when we're bombarded by claims that Jesus was a fabrication of second century fanatics, we're to proclaim him as our Lord and our Savior. And usually these things, these three things, will be sufficient for the world to separate from you. If you hold to these positions, these propositions, you will not have to do the separating. Yes, sir.
I think it was J. Vernon McGee who said, we're not trying to clean the pond up and fish
in. Exactly. So Abram's not forbidden, as Israel will be, from aligning himself with the Amorites, and he welcomed the help of his neighbors in this situation. Their assistance was not an acceptance of their belief system, it was not an acceptance of their gods, but it was a practical arrangement for the protection of the region in which Abram was living. He was living in a dangerous world. We aren't told how many men these allies provided, but it's unlikely that even after they joined with Abram that they were anywhere near the number of fighters that Chedorlaomer had. Abram pursued Lot's captors all the way to Dan, even as far as Damascus. Now, there's some debate over this term, Dan. There's a common phrase that you will see in the Old Testament, from Dan to Beersheba. This phrase mentions the southernmost identifiable point in Canaan, which is Beersheba, and the northernmost point, which is Dan. It's a way of referring to the entire land of Canaan. But the Dan of from Dan to Beersheba was known formerly as Laish. It didn't come to be known Dan until the time of Joshua, in other words, long after this particular time. If this is the Dan in question, then this would be a post-Mosaic alteration of the text so that the contemporary audience would know the location of this particular city. But already twice in the verses we've read today, Bela, an ancient place name, is further defined by for Moses readers by the explanatory phrase Bela, that is Zoar. This is in verse 2. It's in verse 8. Notice also Sidim, which is also an ancient place name, is identified further as the Salt Sea in verse 3, a place we would describe as the Dead Sea. Then beyond that, in Mishpat is identified in verse 6 as Kadesh. So it doesn't make sense to me that if ancient Laish were meant here, why the text would not read Laish, that is Dan, since this is the established pattern in use by Moses in these verses. So I don't think this Dan is the Dan in northern Israel. It just so happens there's another ancient site east of the Jordan River. It's in Gilead. It's also known as Dan, at least it was in ancient times. And it was located northeast of the Dead Sea near the other sites mentioned in this chapter. And I suspect this is the Dan that's meant by the text. According to verse 15, Abram's numerical disadvantage made a frontal assault unwise. So he'd used a little trickery. He planned a surprise attack. He divided his forces, which caused confusion among the enemies, making it hard to determine exactly how many soldiers were engaged in the battle and where they were. Abram ambushed Chedorlaomer's forces by night when they were sleeping. And the result of this was the enemy panicked, chaos ensued, and the victory was Abram's. Those who escaped fled and were pursued by Abram all the way to Damascus and even a little beyond that. We learn in verse 16 that Abram recaptured the spoils taken by the Eastern Alliance and he rescued the captives, including his nephew Lot. What Abram did was an act of unselfish courage, which tells us a lot about his character, but it was a courage that was rooted in his faith. God grants spiritual success, not necessarily worldly success, but spiritual success to those who walk in faith. Without question, this victory would have made Abram famous across the entire region. God had promised to Abram personal fame, and this victory is an example of God being faithful to that promise. Abram's role was to face this challenge faithfully in total dependence on the Lord to give him victory over Lot's captors. And as Lot had promised, those who were associated with Abram, as God had promised, even the unbelievers in this case were blessed. The Amorites received their share of the spoils of war. The men of Sodom were given their freedom. The king of Sodom regained his kingdom, and Lot was freed from his captors. Now, in 1 Peter 5, verses 6 and 7, Peter admonishes us, humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you. This is what Abram did, and this is what God does. He uses men to accomplish his sovereign will. And he'll do the same for you and me. God blesses those who trust him. The Christian life, if we can draw analogies here, is a walk. It's not a sprint. It's more like a marathon. And we don't always know what crises we're going to be asked to face along the way or how God is going to bring us through them. But he'll do it. Just as a coin has two sides, so does this story. On one side is judgment, but on the other side is mercy. This is made evident in God's assessment of Lot. And this is what led to such fun a couple of weeks ago. 2 Peter 2, verses 4 through 10, and I'm going to summarize this. Since God did not spare the angels when they sinned, and since he didn't spare the ancient world but destroyed it with the flood, since God condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, reducing them to ashes as an example for men to see and to learn, and since he rescued Noah and righteous Lot. This is the phrase that led to the discussion a few weeks ago. Righteous Lot. Knowing what we know about Lot, what are we to do with this? Well, first let's realize God rescued Lot more than once. He spared him when Abram lied to the Pharaoh in Egypt. Abram's sin there easily could have resulted in the execution of his entire family, including Lot. God rescued Lot when Abram fought to free him from the Eastern Alliance in this battle of Sodom. He'll rescue him again before destroying the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis chapter 19. But what catches our attention here is Peter refers to Lot as righteous three times in verses 7 and 8, and he includes Lot among the godly in verse 9. Peter says Lot was tormented and oppressed by the immorality of Sodom in verses 7 and 8. And I suspect Lot was. I suspect he was a man torn between the tension between what he wanted and what he knew was wrong. We don't have a problem seeing Noah as righteous, at least not until later. After all, he built the ark, right? But Lot, righteous? Lot's mentioned 47 times in the Bible. A lot of those times are not real flattering. Yes, he was Abram's nephew, but when Lot's farm and Abram's farm began to outgrow the ability of the land to support all their flocks with pasture and water, Abram, the elder patriarch, gave Lot, the smart aleck, undeserving nephew, a choice. You go left, I'll go right. You go right, I'll go left. And of course, Lot saw the good land and he took it, leaving his uncle with the poor land. The text says Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and pitched his tents toward Sodom. There's a lot that can be said and should be said about that phrase, Lot pitched his tents toward Sodom. What it means is really simple. Lot began compromising with the evil culture of Sodom. In Genesis 19, when the two angels came to Sodom to destroy the city, they found Lot sitting at the gate. Lot was involved in the local politics of Sodom. When the men of Sodom came to Lot's house to molest his guests, it was Lot who said, "These men are my guests. You can't have them." But take my virgin daughters and do whatever you want with them. So this is the man Peter says God rescued, righteous Lot. So how is Lot righteous? He doesn't seem very righteous to me. Of course, this is because I'm thinking about righteousness the way men think about righteousness, not the way God thinks about righteousness. Now, I'm not saying God was pleased with some of the things Lot did. He clearly wasn't. But Lot was not righteous because he did the right things. This is hard for us to understand. Everything in our experience is merit-based, except when it comes to our relationship with God. And suddenly, we're asked to live by faith and trust that God will deal with us on the basis of grace, not on the basis of our merits. Oh, there's merit involved, but it isn't our merit. It's the merit of the Son of God. Lot was righteous for the same reason, or I should say for the only reason, any human being is righteous. Lot was righteous because God declared him to be righteous on the basis of the substitutionary death of Jesus Christ on the cross. Lot was a sinner, forgiven by the grace of God, not on the basis of his own good works or the absence of his evil works, but solely on the basis of the cross, even though the cross is another 1,800 years in the future. Paul actually wrote about this in Romans chapter 3, beginning with verse 21. Paul wrote, "But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe. For there's no distinction, for all sinned and are falling short of the glory of God, being justified as a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God he passed over the sins previously committed for the demonstration of his righteousness at the present time, so that he would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus." Propitiation is the act of appeasing the wrath of God against sin. Propitiation turns away God's wrath as a result of a sacrifice that fully satisfied God's perfect justice. Paul says this propitiation occurred when Jesus shed his blood on the cross for the sins of the world. God imputed to Jesus the sins of the world, and Jesus paid for those sins on the cross. Then on the basis of the cross alone, God imputed the very righteousness of Christ to Lot. And that's how Lot was righteous. And it's the only way any of us can attain righteousness before God. Think of it this way. God dealt with Jesus judicially so he could deal with Lot and you and me in grace and mercy. Judgment is certain. It's a given. But whether that judgment is borne by you or by Christ rests on one thing only: your decision regarding the Son of God. Are you willing to trust him alone for the forgiveness of sins? Or are you planning to stand before God and plead your case based on your own merit? Let's close with a word of prayer. It's from Romans 11. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are his judgments! How inscrutable his ways! For who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen.
Good work, Bronte.
Thank you.
You think you want to send it to Mr. Lincoln Riley?
Yeah, I think so.
think he'd get the analogy, though.
I don't think he'd get it.
No.
Well, I was really disappointed that that didn't go over better. I was thrilled to death when I thought of that.
Yeah. It meant more to you than anybody else.
Yeah. Next week, the King of Righteousness. No, I've got to go get the car. Yeah.
Thank you, Rocky. You don't have to stop. Say the lessons.
Thank you. Thank you very much.